Los Fanboys, episode 14. Hello, hola, bienvenidos, and welcome to episode 14 of Los Fanboys, the official movie and TV podcast of Latino Review Media. I am once again joined by our writer extraordinario. See, I gave you the extraordinario this time. Joseph Jammer Medina.
Thank you for that title. I was jealous of it all this time, but I'm happy it's finally passed on to me.
It's, you know, I mean, you've earned it. You've earned your stripes. And then we also got this schmo over here who happens to be the editor-in-chief. His name is Kelvin Chavez.
What's going on, kids?
Oh, no pause this time.
No pause good. This time.
Nice.
No pause.
Yeah, last time he's like, fuck, he called me out. Now I got to say something, like, right on time next time.
Exactly.
So today we have a great story. I do that all the time. We have a great show in store for everybody today. Captain America Civil War did some awesome stuff at the box office, which we'll get into in a bit. We're kind of running the gamut today. Like, we're going from, you know, talking a little Assassin's Creed, which had an awesome trailer drop today or last week. We're going to go to the MCU, the XCU, the DCEU, hop right into Star Wars for a couple stories, and then finish off with a couple of kaiju stories involving Godzilla and Pacific Rim 2. So we're really just going all over the place today. But
we're bursting at the seams.
We are, but let's go ahead and start with the box office. So Captain America Civil War, this is its second weekend out, and it's doing pretty good. It's not bad. I think it had like around a 59% drop at the box office compared to last time for the weekend and domestically. And it brought in, we'll see here, $72.6 million, which is, like I said, a 59% drop compared to, I'm trying to remember last week, 179-ish million. Is that it?
Yeah, ultimately it was like 179.2 or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so not a bad drop. It's pretty much on par for what you expect a big blockbuster to drop. It didn't drop as drastically as, say, Batman v Superman did, but, you know, it's a blockbuster. So a lot of times people will go see it the first weekend and then it'll face a significant drop the weekend after. But Mario, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like the bigger story, and, you know, we're going to get into the more fanboy element talking about Captain America specifically.
Yeah.
But I think the bigger story here is fucking Disney, man. Disney is destroying 2016. Like, they literally, the three biggest movies this year that have all, you know, are all amazingly performing at the box office. You got Zootopia, you got Jungle Book, and now you got Captain America Civil War. Like, if I'm someone who works at Disney or if I own some Disney stock, I'm feeling very, very happy right now. It's absurd the amount of business that studio's, you know, that company is doing. And specifically to have Captain America Civil War doing this well. You know, I was talking about this with some people on Twitter last week and whatnot, that, like, I'm actually surprised at how well it's doing. Like, on paper, when you look at it, considering that they haven't really pushed Spider-Man all that much, he's been on no posters and they've kind of like acted like he's, you know, they haven't really emphasized the Spider-Man card much. On paper, Civil War is like, you know, it's an Avengers story, and it's kind of been there, done that to a certain extent.
Right.
And to me, the fact that it's doing as well as an Avengers movie, like, that's crazy to me. It, to me, that catches me by surprise.
Do you think it would have done better if it was called Avengers Civil War?
You know, it might have actually done better. Yeah, I don't know. I just, this kind of takes me by surprise. Like, earlier this year and late last year when everyone was talking about the big, you know, that this year we were going to have Civil War, we were also going to have Dawn of Justice. To me, the project that had the most juice was Dawn of Justice, because that was like never before seen. You know, it was Batman, it was versus Superman. You had Wonder Woman in there. You had Doomsday being revealed in the second trailer. It had all of this new freshness factor. We knew it was going to launch to the Justice League. Like, it had all kinds of never before seen shit. So on paper, to me, Dawn of Justice had the clear edge. And then Civil War, even though I was very interested in it, you know, I'm like, okay, cool. It'll be more of that sort of Avengers type stuff. And they're going to throw in like a Spider-Man cameo or something and whatever. Like, that's all I really thought of Civil War. It never really struck me that the movie was going to be this huge, you know, behemoth that it's turning out to be right now, where it's been out 19 days and it's already, like, crushing everything.
It's almost at a billion.
Yeah, it's almost at a billion in just 19 days. And honestly, like, maybe I'm in the minority. Maybe everyone expected this movie to do insane. I thought it would fall somewhere between Winter Soldier and Ultron. You know, somewhere in the middle there, probably closer to Ultron. But, like, it's way overperforming by my standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talked about Disney being on a roll. I think it's also worth noting that all the films that they've released that are, you know, that make up those huge numbers, they've all been incredibly well received. Like, Captain America Civil War right now is at 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, Jungle Book's at 95%, and I think Zootopia was around 98%. So these are very respected and appreciated by critics and fans alike, so that's worth noting. Kelvin,
it's kind of...
Oh, go ahead.
No, can I just say just one last thing on Disney? Like, they just seem to kind of get it over there. Like, in terms of, they know how to make, like, an easy-to-digest story that appeals to kids, appeals to grown-ups, and just sort of, you know, will work. It'll sell itself. And, you know, and the con of that, of course, is you're never going to get, like, a groundbreaking, insanely risky, thought-provoking movie. You're going to get something that definitely plays it safe, which is one of the knocks people have against Disney's slate. Even Captain America Civil War, for me, like, I didn't really mention it last week, but I found it to be pretty safe. I was shocked that nobody died, for example.
Spoiler.
And that, like, nothing – well, late spoiler now – you know, so, like, they're always going to play it safe, but from a storytelling perspective, like, they seem to have some sort of company-wide philosophy that's really working, because they know how to make, you know, how to give, how to just crank out hit after hit. I think their last misfire was Tomorrowland, which kind of came and went, and I'm not even sure really flopped that hard. It just, you know, it kind of just didn't really live up to its promise. But as a studio, as a company, they seem to have some sort of, like, philosophy in there that really is connecting with mass audiences.
Kelvin?
Big time. No, I like that. You know, Civil War did so far, what, $940 million?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Worldwide. And it's reached, what, $10 billion mark?
For yeah.
13 they've done over the course of 9 years, which is fucking insane. You know, that tells you, you know, the brains and the marketing and all the people that are, you know, doing, you know, good work over there and Marvel and at Disney. A lot of that's with the marketing too, you know. Although, don't get me wrong, Jungle Book and Zootopia were good movies no matter how you see it. They were very good, you know, and they still got more to come too. You know, you got fucking Rogue One still.
Yeah.
You got, although I have not seen any of the movie that came out before, Alice in Wonderland, I didn't see it. They got that one coming out.
Yep.
You know, and...
And they have Doctor Strange.
They got Doctor Strange in November, you know. So they got a good ass team over there.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling. And you know, and this is more just a quick conspiracy theory. And I'm sorry, this just popped into my head. I've thought about it before too. Like, to me, I find it very intriguing that they haven't really pushed the Spider-Man angle that much in the marketing. And I wonder if it's because, you know, like, they don't want to give Sony too much leverage. You know what I mean? Because Sony does still own the film rights. And as much as there's this cool thing now where Spider-Man is, you know, having his homecoming and finally part of the MCU. Because if you ask me, like, Spider-Man, you know, we already know that his brand is huge. You know, his merchandise sells more than, you know, the other guys. You know, the character internationally is one of the biggest fictional creations ever made. And yet, like, you don't see him on a poster, and you don't, you know, and he was never, like, the central part of a trailer. And I thought that was because his part was really small. You know, I thought maybe he's just a cameo, but, like, he was in the movie, like, a substantial amount. So, they could have really emphasized his, you know, his involvement. I mean, they emphasized Wonder Woman like hell in the Dawn of Justice stuff, and, you know, and her part, what really wasn't that much smaller than Spider-Man's. So, to me, I just wonder if it's because they know that, like, if they push Spider-Man front and center for much of the marketing and the movie does historic business, then Sony can be like, oh, well, that's our guy. and maybe somehow they can hold that over Disney in future negotiations for collaborations like this. That's just my own, you know, I wonder if there's anything to that.
I don't know if there is. It seems, I don't know. I guess there's me thinking, what do you have to lose by doing that? You can't necessarily link two things together, effectively. So it seems weird. I mean, there's no reason why they want less money. I don't think that's the case. I think it's smart not to rely on it. Maybe they even think that Spider-Man's slightly tainted because people are like, oh, Spider-Man again. So maybe they didn't want to show it. Yeah, I'm still waiting in a couple weeks or maybe even next week to hopefully get more Spider-Man-based TV spots. So maybe they can help keep this film have, you know, stronger legs throughout the coming weeks. But we'll see if that happens. I assumed it would happen already, and I was wrong about that. I haven't seen a damn extra Spider-Man teaser yet. So maybe, maybe not.
All right.
You know, and probably also they want to just let the audience experience, you know, the whole surprise thing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. But I feel like it's been long enough to where most people who actually cared about those types of surprises would have seen it already. And it's just about getting sort of the mainstream audiences who know about Spider-Man into their seats at that point. But, you know, those guys are smarter than I am, so I'm sure they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
But moving on from Disney for a bit. We had a pretty awesome trailer drop today. Well, I keep saying today. Last week, Assassin's Creed had a trailer. This has been the film that many of us have been waiting for. Warcraft is definitely coming out. But I think Assassin's Creed is more what a lot of people, like video game fans, have been waiting for. Because it's, I don't know, it's perhaps the most seamless transition from, you know, video game screen to big screen as far as material is concerned. It's more adaptable than I think Warcraft is. We'll see how that film turns out. But we finally got our first look of it. It has Michael Fassbender in the lead role. And what did you guys think of this trailer? Let's start with Kelvin.
I thought it was dope. I thought it was really good. I like the fact that since I do play the video game, it's stuck to the game. Like, a lot of other stuff. So here, that killer money shot at the end, the very end.
That's exactly. I was hoping for the sound of an eagle, and it didn't happen.
But you know, I like the fact that, you know, there was also another money shot where the girl is fighting these two guys, and then the next, you know, she stabs both of them.
Yeah, that was awesome.
That was an awesome shot. So seeing that, and I was like, wow, that's just like the video game. I thought it was, you know, again, very good. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of these trailers like to do that to you. They like to show you, okay, you know, this is good. But then, you know, when the movie comes out, it's not that good. But yeah, we'll have to see, you know. But Mario, you know, you should have a little bit more take on it since you went to the set a few months
ago. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first, just specifically about the trailer, I loved it. I thought it was very good. The only thing I would have absolutely changed is the whole the Kanye bit. You know, the rap music for me kind of like pulled me out of it. Because I know, yes, some of it takes place present day. Some of it takes place in the past. But like hearing Kanye while looking at, like, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, just to me, just sort of, you know, there's a conflict there. It just didn't feel quite right. They could have done better on the music end of things. But in terms of the trailer, you know, I was happy to see it because when I was on the set, you know, what I walked away from was that this movie has the potential to do for video game adaptations what a film like, let's say, Batman Begins did for comic book movies, where suddenly now we can take them really seriously. Because, you know, in speaking with director Justin Kurzel and speaking with, you know, Michael Fassbender and all of them, it was very clear that they have very high ambitions for this, and they're not, you know, they're not taking it lightly. They're not just trying to, like, cash in on the popularity of Assassin's Creed. Like, they have an interesting story to tell. It has a very deep, very interesting mythology, and they're trying to stay true to the games. Like you said, Kelly, I've never played them, but, you know, everyone who I know who's played them, including some of the other journalists I was in London with after we left the set visit, we were talking about it, and they were like, yeah, it really feels like this is going to be a leg of the game franchise, an expansion of the game franchise. They're not just, like, taking the name and some of the familiar elements from the game, they're really taking, you know, they're really just basically building upon what we know already from the games. And so, you know, with the amount of work that they're putting into it, I walked away feeling like this is definitely going to be a game changer. I really didn't plan on saying that, but sure, anyway, it's really going to be a game changer for video game adaptations. And the trailer really sort of drove that point home, that like that feeling I had flying back in October was absolutely spot on. Like this, I think this is going to be a big sort of turning point. And it looks really, really good. I'm excited.
And the interesting thing also is, you know, the release date for the film is like, it's going to go up against Star Wars.
Yeah, the week after Star Wars is when it opens.
Yeah, that could be, they might regret that.
Yeah, we'll see. So actually, I want to talk about my thoughts on the trailer.
Go for it.
So before I say anything, I do want to say the shots of the film look awesome. I think the movie, based on what I'm seeing, looks great. But as a trailer, I'm not really sure this worked for me.
Okay.
I've played probably about 10 hours or so of the video games, like various different ones. So I don't really have a whole lot of insight as to what it's about. But for those who are completely unfamiliar, like I was watching this with my fiance and she watched it with me. And, you know, obviously we kind of rolled our eyes once the freaking Kanye West song came on. I was like, okay, whatever. But let's ignore that for the time being. It kind of gives some idea. It's like, okay, you're going to go back into the past. And then she says, welcome to the Spanish Inquisition, and then just sizzle reel. What's he doing? Mm. Why do we care about what's happening? Like Kirsten was like, I don't understand what's going on. What is this movie about? I don't get it, and it looks boring. So that was her looking into it. Like, she likes these action movies, too. Like, you know, she loves all the Marvel movies and stuff and all the comic book movies. She loves that shit. And this didn't do it for her because there wasn't really – you couldn't really connect with any of the characters. You didn't really know what their goals were. If this was like a teaser trailer, I think it'd be more forgiving. But since this is being sort of advertised as the first trailer, mm-hmm. I think it could have done a bit better with that. Now, all that being said, the actual shots of what we saw, you guys are right. It looks really close to the video game. Looks great. Looks like it could be great. I hope for something more story focused next time so that we could actually have a reason to care about what's going on. Because those who don't know anything about Assassin's Creed, they may just kind of look at it and it might just be noise to them because they don't know what's going on.
See, I wonder if maybe you're being a little too hard on it.
No, I am. I probably am. But like, I think the movie will be fine. I just think as a trailer, it wasn't that great.
Yeah.
Isn't that what they usually do, though? You know, they show you the first trailer, you don't know what the hell is it about, and they show you the second trailer, and then the next thing you know, now you know what's it about.
Yeah, and if they do that, that's absolutely fine. I just think for mainstream audiences, I'm not sure this would hit as well. For you know what it is? I think it might hit better.
And it's funny you say that because your girlfriend saw it, my wife saw it, because I took her to see Money Monster over the weekend, and they showed it, then she goes, hey, isn't that the game you play? That shit looks hot.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people in the theater really thought it looked hot. Like, literally, they were clapping at the end of the trailer.
So that's it.
That money shot, everyone was like, yo, that's hot, you know, and they were all clapping about it. So I was like, oh, shit, well, all these people really know about Assassin's Creed. Mm-hmm. You know, because there was a lot of couples in that theater watching Money Monster, mm-hmm. you know, so. And even my daughter was with us, and she was like, wow, that looks really good.
Well, it's official. Kelvin's wife trumps Jammer's girlfriend. So, I think I can kind of see where you're coming from, mm-hmm. but I guess I think we're forgetting because, you know, it was longer than your typical teaser trailer. Yeah, it clocked in at like 2:14, I think, mm-hmm. which most teaser trailers tend to be like, you know, a minute and a half. But I think we're forgetting that this is, in essence, just a teaser. And the teaser is always just mainly like sizzle reel stuff. Then it's like usually trailer one, which comes after that, is the longer, you know, 2.5 minute, 3 minute one that really expands on the story and introduces you what's to come. Trailer two is like starts showing you that plus more action. Then trailer three is please watch this fucking movie.
Right.
But, you know, so that tends to be like the general path. So the fact that this one to you felt like more just kind of like, you know, mainly a sizzle reel, you know, I think that's just kind of what they always are, you know, the initial teaser. But, you know, I know where you're coming from. I respect you and your girlfriend. And, you know, we'll wait and see when trailer one comes out, if maybe that does.
Yeah,
the
when the next trailer comes out and it does something more story based and does the trick, you know, I think this movie's, I'm hoping for the best. This movie better be awesome in my mind because I've been waiting for the video game movies to take off for a long ass time. So I wish nothing but the best. But as like a trailer for general audiences, I'm not sure it worked for those in the know who either know Assassin's Creed or no, you know, film like us, I think it worked because we kind of already have sort of a basis to stand on. But
yeah,
you know,
and I have a special treat for readers and even you, Medina.
Oh,
who you know, for those of you who want to know and fill in those blanks as to what the real story is going to be and how it builds on and works with the games and whatnot. When I put up entry 2 to my set diary for Assassin's Creed, I'm going to include all the story bits that I was able to pick up from the interviews and kind of give you a more of an outline as to what we can expect.
Sounds good. Look forward to it.
All right.
So moving on from Assassin's Creed back to the MCU for a bit, there's been a lot of news regarding the cast of Black Panther, or, you know, the cast stuff behind the scenes. Lupita Nyong'o, who you guys may know from Star Wars The Force Awakens, 12 Years a Slave, The Jungle Book. She's been working with Disney quite a bit recently, and it looks like that's likely to continue. She's in talks to play a role in Black Panther. And then in addition to her, we also have Michael B. Jordan. You know, this is going to be his third time working with director Ryan Coogler, who also worked with him on Fruitvale Station and Creed. And yeah, he's going to play an unknown role in Black Panther. But more than that, Kevin Feige recently said that Black Panther will have a cast of 90% African or African American, which is awesome news. What do you guys have to say about all of this?
Well, there's a couple things. You know, It's interesting to me to have Michael B. Jordan, you know, jumping onto this film, considering he was just attached to the Fantastic Four sequel, where he played Johnny Storm, and we all know how that movie turned out. It was like an epic, disastrous situation over there for Fox. And the fact that this news came out the same day that Kinberg was making the rounds talking about how he still wants to make a Fantastic Four sequel with, you know, the original cast, which would include Jordan. So it leads to a situation where, like, you know, if his part in Black Panther is of any substance and for whatever reason recurs in any other Black Panther films, you know, he might be in two different comic book franchises that are running at the same time, potentially speaking. So, and it's also just, you know, it's just kind of cool for me to see Jordan and Coogler working together again, because Coogler's only made, you know, two movies and Jordan was in both, and this is going to be his third and Jordan will be there too. You know, it's always cool to me to see when you have these filmmaker actor relationships where just, you know, they just, you know, obviously there's a shorthand there and they like working with each other so much that they will, you know, they will do this many, many a time. So that sort of stuff I find
like
interesting.
Like Martin Scorsese and Leo DiCaprio.
Exactly. Yeah. What about the general casting stuff in regards to the race thing? Which is
a big makes
deal
sense
nowadays, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, it's Black Panther and it's in Wakanda. I mean, yeah, you got to have, you know, a mainly African-American cast. And I think, you know, I don't think it'll be a problem, because at this point the Marvel brand has shown that, like, people will buy into anything. So, if, you know, sometimes studios like to say that, you know, you tend to get the feeling that certain movies are like, you know, this is going to be like a black movie for black audiences and whatever, and it's all black subject matter. But this one looks like it's probably going to still have that crossover mainstream appeal because it's Marvel. And Marvel now has enough, you know, they've got enough ammo and enough going on in their war chest that they can make a predominantly black movie and not worry that it's only going to appeal to black audiences.
Right. And I really appreciate this, because this could have easily been a situation where they had, you know, mostly white people, just because that's the tendency. And they could say, well, you know, Wakanda is fictional, so we could do whatever the hell we want with it. So they could have easily gone that route, but the fact that they didn't, I think, kind of speaks to what they're trying to do over there. What do you think, Kelvin?
I think that, you know, were you actually surprised that it was an all African-American cast? No. Is it going to hurt the film? No, absolutely not. One thing that I have learned is that African-American audiences support their film no matter how you see it.
So oh, yeah.
It's a humongous leap, a big plus for Marvel to do something like this, to be honest with you, because if you want to attract the African American audience, and that's your key audience to get, you got a gold mine with this film.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, they definitely go out in droves to see, like, all those
exactly,
like you said, black subject matter movies.
Look at all the Tyler Perry films.
Yeah,
you know, all those movies make so much money. and they're not even comic book related.
Yeah. You know? So and they're not even that good usually.
Can you imagine with a Marvel film, you know what I mean? You have Ryan Coogler, you have this girl, you have, you know, Michael B. Jordan now and stuff like that and so on and so on, you know. But I'm not surprised about Michael B. Jordan being in this film, being that, you know, he has worked with Ryan Coogler on all his films so far.
And he's hot right now, too, and Disney loves that.
And and he's hot. And the fact that it's funny that you were mentioning Mario about he was playing Johnny Storms. And I was like, at the moment you said that, I was like, so did Captain America. So did Chris Evans. He played Johnny Storm as well. Fantastic.
That's true. Well, think about that angle. This is the second Johnny Storm to cross over into the
MCU. Exactly, the second Johnny Storm to cross over. Yeah. But speaking of Fantastic Four, I'm going to throw in a little bochinche right now.
Oh, my God.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, a little bochinche. I mean, I'm trying to get it confirmed. It's not been confirmed. I've spoken to some producers. They don't know anything about it just yet or whatnot. But there is a rumor going around in Hollywood that Marvel has approached Fox to work something out with them for Fantastic Four. Now, is it for a reboot? Not really. I don't think they'll do a reboot for Fantastic Four. I think a lot of it has to do with Silver Surfer. And the only reason they can use Silver Surfer, I believe, is because they want to use him, I think, in Infinity Wars or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
It could be that, or it could be that they want to just do the whole Fantastic Four all over again. I actually went up to Anthony Russo and asked him that. At a screening that I saw him in, and he said that it's a little difficult because they don't want an X-Men related type of thing, or, you know, the whole X-Men thing. So the deal that I heard that was in place was that they wanted to, you know, get a hold of Fantastic Four, maybe do it all over again like they did for Spider-Man, except that there is no X-Men included in here. You know what I mean?
So it'd be like they'd be absorbed into the MCU, and then X-Men would still continue to be on its own.
Exactly, just like that. But that's the rumor. And then I asked some other people, you know, and they've also heard the same thing, that Marvel has already, you know, put something in place for Fox. I've talked to the producers. You know, they're always going to deny it. So, you know, that's why I never put it online, because, you know, they don't want to really say anything about it. So.
Yeah. I mean, personally, just getting back to the cast itself being predominantly African-American, I'm a little disappointed. You know, I honestly was expecting, you know, Tilda Swinton to channel her inner. I was expecting her to channel her inner Eddie Murphy and just play all the supporting roles, you know, around Chadwick Boseman. But,
and
you know,
I think we could all agree that that's a missed opportunity by Marvel. Yeah. And they really yeah. missed the boat on that one.
But you got Tilda Swinton there. You may as well just, you know, let's put her to work. I mean, what is this shit?
I don't know. Maybe next time. Talk to Kevin Feige.
Yeah. Oh, and I owe someone. I owe a favor to Michael K. Williams, who you know, the actor who was made famous in The Wire, and is also going to appear in Assassin's Creed, and he's got a lot going on. When I met him in London, I promised that I would start a rumor that he was going to be in Black Panther, so that Marvel would cast him, because, you know, his son wants his dad to be in a Marvel movie. So you heard it here first, folks. Michael Kenneth Williams is going to be in Black Panther.
Whoa, exclusive.
Yeah, I know. I mean, not really. But listen, just somebody make it happen, because Michael liked that idea and he shook my hand and he gave me a pound. So let's make that happen, somebody. Michael Kenneth Williams in Black Panther.
Sounds good. Well, speaking of making things happen, over at Fox, they're making an R-rated Wolverine movie happen. In a recent interview with Simon Kinberg, he confirmed, he says, it's a very radical, bold, different Wolverine than you've ever seen in any of these movies. It takes place in the future. And as you and others have reported, he says this speaking to an outlet, which I, for some reason, can't remember. I apologize. Oh, it was Collider. Anyways, as you reported, it is an R-rated movie. It's violent. It's kind of like a Western in its tone. It's very cool, very different film. So, yeah, it's confirmed that Wolverine 3 is going to be an R-rated film. It's been speculated to be an Old Man Logan storyline, but so far there's been no confirmation of that. Kelvin, what are your thoughts on this R-rated Wolverine flick?
I'm not surprised at all, actually. Especially, I mean, obviously you heard the rumors that they wanted to do an R-rated film and so on and so on. But after watching X-Men Apocalypse, there's a scene in there that they have to do it rated R. Like, when you see that scene, It's like a 2-3 minute scene. You're gonna say, it's no surprise that it's gonna be rated R. You know, so I'm pretty much happy. I thought that Wolverine should have been rated R ever since X2, to be honest with you.
Well, how is it that like a scene out of a PG-13 movie got you convinced that it would be an R-rated movie the next time?
I don't want to spoil it for you, but it's really fucking brutal.
But it's PG-13, so it's like that. Yeah, prove
they how can you gonna have a PG-13 movie when the guy is literally fucking stabbing everybody, blood splattering all over the place? Like, you literally see blood going everywhere, like it's everywhere. Hold on.
You know what I'm thinking?
What's that?
I'm thinking, you know how like in every PG-13 movie, the studios and the MPAA, they have like an agreement of like how much sort of risque stuff you can do before it becomes R, and like they allot you a certain amount of like almost rated R level stuff. I wonder if like they wisely just gave Logan's appearance in Apocalypse all of those moments. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good point.
They saved them all up so that in his one little scene, he does the right amount of R-rated things, just enough to keep it rated PG-13, but like one more stabbing and it would have been rated R, you know? So I wonder if they just did something like that.
And like I said, when you see X-Men, this new one that's coming out in like, 2 weeks, you're going to see, like, they got away with it having a PG-13, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Like, literally. I mean, and X2, I don't know. I know you guys saw it. But that scene where he's fighting
the military.
In the mansion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You saw him stabbing, you know, the military guys or the soldiers or whatnot. But there was no, you know, blood or violent or slashing of the face or nothing like that.
Blood.
And this one, he goes beyond that. It's nice. Really good, though, you know? So I'm not really surprised at all of a Wolverine R-rated film. I always wanted, actually, to see R-rated.
X-rated X-Men. Triple X-Men.
Triple X-Men. But no, I'm not surprised at all, to be honest. Not at all.
All right. Yeah. I mean, me neither. You know, to me, it feels very fitting. You know, Logan is a character that has screamed for this sort of treatment for a while. So to me, this just feels like long overdue. And I know that they had the unrated cut of the Wolverine. So I know they were trying to, you know, they were playing with this stuff even a couple years ago. And then they were thinking about it for Wolverine 3. And I'm sure the success of Deadpool just completely made it like a non-issue. Like, now we know this is what we're doing. And to me, it just makes me like a lot more excited because, you know, I know I've mentioned this like 1,017 times, but I'm not a huge comic book guy. So I don't know a lot about Old Man Logan, but I was speaking to a friend of mine who knows all this stuff, and I asked him to sort of summarize it for me. And he's like, it's like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven movie, but with Wolverine.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh shit, that sounds awesome. So to me, the idea that now we're going to get that sort of story, like an Unforgiven with Hugh Jackman going out in a blaze of glory with no limits. It'll be R-rated and they'll be able to show and do practically whatever they want. Not X-rated, of course. But, you know, now I'm definitely much more intrigued. I'm much more interested, especially also just, you know, James Mangold's. In one of his other movies that got me excited about his involvement with any of this was 310 to Yuma, which I thought was a really, really good remake. I don't know if you guys saw that.
It was a Western with Christian Bale, right?
Yeah. Like, I thought that was really, really damn good. So the idea of having Mangold, having Jackman, having the Old West storyline, you know, Old West sort of feel in the future, the Unforgiven bit, and an R rating now, I think we have a nice recipe for success here.
Right. It's something new. Like, we've seen a lot of Wolverine, and this is kind of the note that we want Hugh Jackman to go out on, something, you know, basically no holds barred. You know, everything that we wish we could have seen in the past 15 years from the character all sort of squeezed into one movie. So, yeah, I think it's great news. And, yeah, on the heels of Deadpool, it's less of a risk, I guess you could call it. They see that, oh, yeah, you could actually do some good stuff with an R-rated film. You don't necessarily need the 5-year-olds to go into the movie in order to make good money. So that's great stuff. On the note of Deadpool, there was a recent interview that Singer had with Variety. And in it, he was talking about incorporating Deadpool into the XCU, the X-Men shared universe. Of course, he's in the XCU as it stands, but incorporating him into the, you know, X-Men itself, X-Men proper. He didn't rule it out, but he basically said it's a bit difficult. This is what he said. If you take a character as reverent and meta as Deadpool and connect him to something as grounded and serious as X-Men, you have to do it carefully and gently. When you drop them all in together, it can be a disaster. That has to be done delicately, but there's plenty of room to do it. So yeah, okay. that was pretty much it. Yeah.
All right.
What are your thoughts on that, Mario?
No, I mean, it just sounds like a wise approach. You know, it doesn't really, you know.
No insight, really. It's like, yeah, of course it has to be done delicately. It has to be done right. They're very different properties, and we understand the whole fan service aspect of seeing these characters together is huge, but at the same time, you don't want to force it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a question I've had since I saw Deadpool. Like, I walked out of that thinking, like, how are they going to do this now? You know, it's such a different kind of movie than the X-Men movies are. So how, like, you know, when it comes time to bring those ideas together and you have him sharing the screen with, you know, James McAvoy and the rest of the X-Men people, you know, how do you treat that with a character that breaks the fourth wall and basically makes fun of everything that you're looking at?
I mean,
so yeah, it's going to be interesting.
I could see him being handled kind of like how Quicksilver was handled in Days of Future Past, where he literally just has a couple of scenes, like they need him for a specific mission. And he comes in, he's wisecracking as usual. They tone down the language again. Maybe they save their F-bomb for his character. And then he doesn't break the fourth wall, because obviously that wouldn't be fitting. But, you know, maybe he points out things, but he doesn't necessarily look at the camera and say stuff. So it can be done, I think. It's just a matter, of doing it carefully. But if they were to do it, I could imagine it being pretty much a scene or two and then gone.
Yeah, that would work. And they could even keep his stuff limited, you know, to the with the fourth wall breaking stuff, like literally just kind of give him like a quick look to the camera at a certain point if something somewhat absurd happens, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would work personally. I would be weirded out if that were to happen in an X-Men movie.
I don't know. We'll see.
Kelvin, any last things to say about that?
No, not really. I mean, I just think, would it work if they put Deadpool something like how they did for Spider-Man, you know, have him in there for a little bit, have good half hour, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Probably even less than a half hour. And one thing before we move away from X-Men, sure. I do just want to point out Singer's quote too, that has me excited for Apocalypse and potentially for Wolverine 3, which is, you know, I know you've already seen the movie, but you know, Singer mentions that, you know, the reason that his character, that Wolverine's appearance, is going to have a lot of people talking is because it's going to be one of the first real times we see him in like full on berserker mode. You know, we've gotten like, you know, teases of it here and there, but we're apparently going to see really that Weapon X berserker primal insane place that, you know, we've seen in comic books, we've seen in even in video game modes, in video games and cartoons, but we're going to get our first true cinematic berserker mode. And the fact that they're going to really sort of, you know, bring that into the cinematic lexicon has me excited.
Cool. Well, I have a question for you guys. Who here expected the Gambit movie was actually going to happen?
I did. I know that things got a little hairy when it got moved from out of 2016 and then out of the slate entirely. But I had a feeling, because you don't attach people like, you know, Channing Tatum and Doug Liman to a project if you don't really have confidence in it. So I always kind of had a feeling that the project would rebound. Why do you ask?
Well, I ask because apparently it's still in development. In a recent interview with producer Simon Kinberg, he said with FlickeringMyth.com, "We've got to get the script right. We just didn't get the script to the place where we all thought the movie deserved. So we're still working on the script. We're working very close, actually, to being done with the script. And the hope is that Channing Tatum has a couple of movies he has to shoot, but that we would be shooting at the end of this year or the beginning of next year. And as far as the status of it, he says it's looking really good. I'm not going to say anything about it content-wise. I think one of the things I've learned from all these movies, and maybe the lesson we've best learned for me on Deadpool, is the most important thing is getting the tone and the voice right, and that the storytelling, the actual narrative, the plots are sort of interchangeable and disposable ultimately. If you ask what your favorite movies are, you're not going to tell me about the plot. You're going to tell me you love this character. And so what we've really tried to do with Gambit is make sure that we get the voice of that character right and the tone of the comics 100% on the page. It's very unique tone. It's unique from Deadpool. It's unique from X-Men. It's a heist movie that's never been done in these kinds of films before. He's a con man, and so that's really where we've spent our time. Mario, what are your thoughts on this?
Interesting. It sounds like the way to go. You know, if they're going to make this Gambit movie at all, which we've discussed before, I believe, like maybe a month or two ago, we talked about, like, does anyone really want to see a Gambit solo movie? You know, he's a fan favorite character, and people have been asking for him ever since the first X-Men movie in 2000. But does anyone want to see just a standalone Gambit story? You know, usually when we think of Gambit, he's part of the X-Men. So if they do have to take some special time to figure out what it is about him that makes him special enough to have his own story. And if they're going to go the whole heist movie sort of way, then that's intriguing, the con man way. Because honestly, I don't know a hell of a lot about Gambit. I know he likes the cards on fire.
Right. I don't know much anything outside of X-Men the Animated Series, which I loved as a kid.
The same thing here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I know he's cool. He has a very cool look. I was Gambit for Halloween once, like, friggin' 10 years ago. So, like, you know, I know that he's got an overall cool feel to him, but I don't know much about him. So if they make him, if they play up this whole interesting sleight of hand, con man sort of thing, you know, I think that would be cool. And I'm glad that they're taking the time to really develop it and not just basically relying on the fact that, hey, you know, a lot of fans have been asking for Gambit, so let's just make a Gambit movie. You know, it seems like they really want to try to find what it is that makes the character special and why it is that so many fans have latched onto him before they move forward.
And
so,
maybe scale back that budget a bit.
Yeah, maybe.
Because they realize,
They should do something what they did for Deadpool and for Ant-Man, to be honest with you. Show a little sizzle reel type of thing before they actually started shooting the real film.
Oh, I'm sure they'll do that. You mean show it to audiences?
Yeah, like they did that supposedly leaked footage that they filmed for Deadpool, and then that's what got the film greenlit. The same thing with Ant-Man when Edgar Wright went to Comic-Con and he showed, you know, his version of Ant-Man, and they actually used some of that footage. It wasn't the same footage, but it'll say they shot the same thing.
That concept,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
They should do something for Gambit just to see, okay, let's get a feel of what people think about this, you know?
That's not a bad idea, actually. That'd be pretty cool. But yeah, I think a big part in my mind is that maybe they realized we don't need to go $200 million for this film. We just need to actually – the most important part is to nail the character and nail the tone, as he said there. So let's go back to the drawing board and try to maybe cut this where we can cut it and, you know, get rid of the unnecessary explosions where they're not needed. So –
which for me, honestly, I think that's the best way to go. And in general, with these, you know, with these blockbuster movies, sometimes I think big budgets hurt a movie.
Yeah.
Because when you get, you know, when you give a filmmaker like basically unlimited resources, you know, they could lose focus. You know, like, oh, well, I can do 89 different things right now, so I'm going to do a little bit of all of them.
Yeah.
You know, when you have the tighter constraints, it really makes you focus on telling the best possible story and making your characters as interesting as possible.
And it makes go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
It makes you creative at problem solving, because that's what filmmaking is basically a series of problem solving things. Those are words. Basically, it's a series of people doing like problem solving. And when you get more creative, you know, accidents happen that end up maybe working in the movie's favor. And yeah, you don't necessarily get those happy accidents if you have all the money in the world and are able to do things 100%, you know, with money. And it's just – creativity is driven by constraints.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen.
Yeah, so it's like if you have the right constraints, you can make something that's truly exceptional. You know, that's why a lot of people, you know, a lot of film lovers love indie films, because they're restrained usually in budget and they're able to do things that are, you know, a little bit different. They aren't necessarily tried and true, and it makes it maybe polarizing but also beloved. So hopefully they take that approach with Gambit.
Yeah, and you know, and if they're able to get Lyman back on, I know he moved on to a different project when the film fell off the slate.
Right.
But if they're able to get Lyman back, you know, and with Channing Tatum still at the forefront, I think, you know, especially with the con man angle, thinking about Channing Tatum, you know, swindling and conning people and all that sort of stuff. Like, that sounds like now I'm much more interested than I was before. So yeah. I hope it all comes back together.
Speaking of coming back together, it sounds like the Fantastic Four may come back together. We kind of alluded to this earlier on in the podcast.
Yeah.
In a recent interview with Den of Geek, Simon Kinberg talked some more, and he admitted that Fantastic Four wasn't necessarily them putting their best foot forward. He said, "We didn't make a good movie, and the world voted, and I think they probably voted correctly. And you can't make a good movie every time out. Nobody does, or not everybody does. We actually have a pretty good batting average, all things considered. But I think we made many mistakes when we made that movie, mistakes that we learned from and we would not repeat." Now, in regards to a sequel, he went on to say, "We want to make another Fantastic Four movie. We love that cast. I mean, if I were to say to you how Michael B. Jordan and Miles Teller and Kate Mara and Jamie Bell are great actors, we love the cast. I love the comic. I mean, I love it almost as much as I love X-Men." And then he went on to say, "We'll try to be truer to the essence of the tone of Fantastic Four, which is completely, well, not completely, but largely distinct from the X-Men, which is brighter, funner, more optimistic tone. I think we tried to make a darker Fantastic Four movie, which seemed like a radical idea, but we were kind of messing with the DNA of the actual comic instead of trusting the DNA of the comic. We're working really hard on figuring that out. Nothing would make me happier than the world embracing a Fantastic Four movie." So nothing really set in stone here, but even though like the Fantastic Four sequel was thrown off their slate next year, and that's since been removed because, you know, the first one failed, they're still kind of tossing around this idea, supposedly, of an X-Men sequel with this same X-Men, of a Fantastic Four sequel with the same cast. Mario, what would you say to another Fantastic Four movie with this cast?
Well, full disclosure, I didn't even bother seeing Fantastic Four. The buzz for me was so toxic that it was enough for me to not even want to bother. If they made a sequel and the buzz was better, then I would check it out. I understand what Kinberg is saying in terms of, you know, with this cast, you probably can make something pretty special because these are all very good actors. These are all like up and coming, the future of Hollywood type of actors. And it was a bit of a casting coup for them to get all four of them. So if they're able to get their ducks in a row to make a sequel and it looked like any good, you know, I'd be down for that. But something else that I took away from his quote here is it got me thinking about the X-Men franchise overall, the whole idea of messing with the DNA, as he put it. You know, if you think about it, when the X-Men began back in 2000, you know, what Singer was trying to do was kind of play it safe. At the time, the comic book movie wasn't what it has become. You know, it was still somewhat of a, you know, people were still sort of reeling from 1997's Batman and Robin, where the whole sort of comic book thing sort of came to a head and collapsed in on itself. So when he sort of came at X-Men, he was trying to do it in such a way where you do mess with the DNA, where you essentially, you pull some of the core concepts from the comics, but you mainly adapt it into something much more mainstream, much more, so, you know, quote unquote, relatable. That's why, like, you know, a lot of the costumes were sort of dialed down. A lot of the subtext about being a mutant and just feeling different was played up more than the actual comic book elements. But meanwhile, over the years, if you look at where we are now as opposed to where we were in 2000, you know, nowadays people expect the comic book movies to be a lot more reflective of the books themselves. Like, now we are a lot, you know, more as a culture, more in tune with the idea of outlandish costumes and crazy powers and things being much more closer to the books.
Right.
And I find it interesting to watch the X-Men franchise sort of evolve to sort of follow that. You know, if you notice, more and more the movies are becoming more and more like the comic book counterparts, and the characters are being recast, and the storylines that are being woven into these films adhere a lot closer to what the books are. And to me, it's just been interesting to sort of, you know, track that evolution from, you know, in 2000, it was totally fine to mess with the DNA. And in this day and age, people want, you know, to actually see what it was that, you know, the actual stories, the actual, you know, what it was that made these characters matter to begin with. And I think Josh Trank was trying to do more of the 2000 approach, where, you know, you kind of mess with the Fantastic Four to tell a different kind of story. And Kinberg now is being a realist and going, well, you know, that doesn't work anymore. Nowadays, people want to see, you know, the actual, you know, the actual Fantastic Four.
Yeah, not comic just books a come riff to life.
Yeah, exactly. Not just a riff on the Fantastic Four, but actually bring the Fantastic Four as we know them to life. So, you know. That was my big takeaway from what he had to say, that he admits that the messing with the DNA no longer really works anymore.
That's true, and like what you said, Mario, I didn't even see the film. Right nowadays, when you see it on cable, I'm like, I heard it was bad, and I just switched the channel. So
it wasn't that bad. Here's the thing: it was boring. Like it wasn't
exactly.
I know, but I mean, like it was the first half. It seemed like he was setting up for stuff, but then it just kind of shit the bed and didn't really go anywhere. And was boring. So it was like, it just had the stink of sort of the studio messing with it too much. But go ahead and continue.
But no. And then it comes back to the whole bochinche that I said earlier. You know, should Marvel come in and help out and do something about this whole Fantastic Four? Because it seems that there's a lot of people who do like that that team. You know what I mean?
Do they? I don't know anybody who's actually read Fantastic Four. The only one I know...
I mean, I grew up with Fantastic Four as a kid when they used to show it on TV, you know, on cartoons and stuff like that. I used to like it a lot back then, but then you had the Tim Story's Fantastic Four, and that was fucking awful.
Yeah, my only exposure to the Fantastic Four in the comics is when they showed up for a brief moment in Astonishing X-Men, which was, I forget when that came out, like, I don't know, a decade ago or something, a while ago. Exactly. But yeah, I don't care. I know George R. R. Martin, the guy who wrote Game of Thrones, he fucking fell in love with the Fantastic Four because, ironically, at the time, they were sort of the most relatable superheroes back then because they actually, you know, they dealt with more internal struggles than most other comic books at the time. But since then, it seems like the perception, at least, of Fantastic Four has definitely changed into something more lighthearted and fluffy, you know, not unlike Tim's story. And I think Tim's story kind of definitely shaped what most mainstream audiences think of the Fantastic Four. So because of my lack of exposure with the comics itself, I really don't know what the actual tone of the Fantastic Four is in the comic book. Do any of you know what that is?
I mean, I think, look, when this whole thing was happening with, when they were shooting Fantastic Four, the Josh Trank film, there was a lot of rumors going on that, not one single set picture was released, or there wasn't no kind of set pictures online for it until somebody actually took a picture of a big statue of the Thing.
I remember that.
And then I put it up, and then all these things started happening, and they said, there's no trailer, there's no this, there's no, they were already bad-mouthing the movie. Then you had rumors about the director being an a-hole and yada, yada, yada. So then, you know, Kimber and I spoke about, you know, he and I had an exclusive, you know, interview about the whole thing. And then their whole thing was, I think he wanted to make the ultimate Fantastic Four from that comic. I think that's what they were going for.
Yeah, from the Ultimates, yeah.
Yeah, from the Ultimate. And then I don't know what happened, to be honest. Like, again, I didn't see the film, so I don't know if they went that route or not. Maybe you know this, Joseph, but...
I'm not familiar with the Ultimate Fantastic Four, so I can't really speak to that.
So that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to do the young version of them and yada, yada, yada. And then, you know, I really don't know what, you know, direction they went because of
right.
all
well,
the
I know. I heard some stuff. I was speaking with someone who worked on this, I want to say, like, secondhand information that he heard. That it seemed like from, so don't take this to the bank, but it seemed like from what he understood, by day one of shooting, Josh Trank seemed to have already been fed up with all the stuff that the studio made him do to the point where he was like not even there in spirit. That's what I heard, but you know, who knows how true that actually is. So it's like, I'm not sure.
No, and I can, you're probably right, because that's the same thing that I was hearing was that, you know, he was a little frustrated because he wasn't allowed to, I guess, to tell the story that he wanted to tell.
Right.
It seems that the studio got involved and said, no, you're telling the story that we want to tell, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but you'll never know the truth.
Yeah. Just to kind of get back to your question, too, in terms of what the tone of the books are.
Yeah.
I haven't read the books, but from what I've gathered, ironically, the Tim Story movies are closer to what the actual Fantastic Four is supposed to be. It's a little more lighthearted, a little more comedic, a little more about a dysfunctional family, that sort of thing. So in that way, the Tim Story movies were probably closer to what the Fantastic Four is supposed to be. But just as with everything, it's all in the delivery, you know, so you know, all in the execution, you know. So he may have had the right idea, tonally speaking. The Tim Story Fantastic Four movies, I believe, were probably closer to what the books are and closer to what it was about those characters that made people love them so much, the whole dysfunctional family thing. But just the execution was just fairly piss poor. And it looks like, you know, and the budget was not enough to make it even look good. That's why you had Galactus. That was a big cloud.
Yeah.
So, you know, but tonally speaking, I actually think those were more in line with the books and more, you know, more demonstrative of what it is about those characters that have made them endure all these years to begin with.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on from Fantastic Four to the DCEU. Last week, there's some rumors going around as to, from Birth Movies Death, as to who the actual villain of the Justice League is going to be. So if you haven't seen Batman v Superman, or you do not want to be spoiled, you probably want to skip ahead to the next segment, which you could check out on the show notes of the episode. So if you don't want to hear any spoilers, just go away. We don't want to hear you, or go forward. Anyway, it sounds like this isn't really a huge surprise, but you know, Darkseid was kind of alluded to in Batman v Superman with like the Ohm symbol in the nightmare back Batman sequence. So we were thinking, oh yeah, it's going to be Darkseid. But obviously, it didn't seem to me, at least, that it was going to be the case, because it's just, as we learn with these movies, you have to foreshadow a lot. They foreshadowed Thanos, you know, in Avengers, and it's how many movies later, and he's still on the horizon. You know, it's been about 6 movies since then, and there's still plenty of time before we hit Thanos. So you have to plant these seeds early on. So I never thought that he'd be the villain of the first film, of the first Justice League film. And yeah, then as soon as Batman v Superman came out, we had that scene with Lex Luthor sitting in that pool of gunk and, you know, that basically the garbage from the compactor in Star Wars, it looked like. And he's with this weird creature who's holding like these mother boxes. It's very alien looking. I thought it might be an interpretation of Darkseid, but it's since been sort of speculated that's actually Steppenwolf, a really weird version of Steppenwolf, who in the comics looks a lot more human. He is the uncle of Darkseid and sort of a high ranking leader of the sort of the Apocalypse Invasion Force. And I guess that's going to be the main villain for Justice League Part 1, at least according to Birth Movies Death. Mario, what do you have to say about this?
I mean, I've never heard of Steppenwolf, ever. You know, and if I've ever been a comic book person, it's been DC. I've read, you know, a shit ton of Superman comics. And Steppenwolf is not, it's never been on my radar. I've never heard of him. I couldn't picture him. I couldn't tell you what his abilities are. You know, I don't know anything about him. I know he's part of the whole Apocalypse bit. To me, I'm a little bit, you know, I'm not sure that was the best choice. You know, I know some people say that, like, you know, mainstream audiences didn't know who Thanos was either, and Marvel's pushing forward Thanos. But even me, like, with my limited comic book knowledge, I may not know much about Thanos, but I've always been able to picture him. I know who he is. I can picture him with wearing the Infinity Gauntlet. So even with my limited knowledge, I know who Thanos is. Steppenwolf, I know dick about. So, you know, maybe they have a great storyline lined up for him, and then, you know, the trailers will make Steppenwolf seem epic. But as of right now, reading that name and based on that deleted scene, I'm just sort of left, let's just say, neutral on the matter.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I don't know dick about Steppenwolf at all. I was shocked that, you know, that was reported. I was like, who the fuck is Steppenwolf, you know?
Yeah.
So I have no clue.
I mean, I think He's definitely not incredibly memorable, but the idea for me, at least based on what I've read, but the thing for me is that at least with if you compare this to Marvel, I know DC is a different ball of wax because they pride themselves on their rogues gallery of people, which they have a billion of, and they're all really great. But Marvel, they don't really advertise their villains very much. And Thanos, yeah. he's just kind of been sitting on his throne for like 6 or 7 movies now, and he's going to be sitting on that fucking throne for another, you know, 6 or 7 movies. So it's like, whatever. Like they've had all this time to sort of build familiarity with the audience and stuff. Obviously, you're not going to have that much time with this. But my point is people mostly don't go to the theaters for the villains unless it's like the Joker, or you know, some really really iconic ones. And you know, as much as yeah, I knew who Thanos was, or at least I seen pictures of him back then and stuff, and with the Infinity Gauntlet. But I'm never really drawn to these movies because of the villains. Yeah. So I don't think it's going to break it. I don't think it's definitely a mistake. It's all about how they approach the Justice League themselves. You know, Marvel has proven that having a superhero-centric approach to their films is a way to go. Yes, it is a bit underwhelming when we get to the villains and they're a bit, you know, lacking overall. But on the whole, it's not a bad way to go.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I'm a little surprised, I will say, about that they're seemingly holding off on Darkseid, because with everything else, they've jumped in with both feet. You know, we went right to Batman versus Superman. We went right to Doomsday, right to the death of Superman. So they don't seem to mind hitting the express and going right towards some of these big points. So for the fact that they wouldn't just go straight to Darkseid and instead give us Steppenwolf, who you know, is much more obscure. To me, that's a little surprising. So, and remember, this is still just a rumor. You know, who knows? Maybe it is Darkseid and Steppenwolf is going to be more of like a mini boss. Yeah, I use the mini boss sort of phrase like from video games. Like he'll be in there and he might be someone that they deal with somewhere in part one of Justice League. But part two, will, you know, the ultimate villain will still be Darkseid. Like that wouldn't surprise me.
Well, they do go on to say that Darkseid will be, you know, in some capacity a part of the film, but, you know, they're not going to be the big bad. So they'll be kind of around, maybe pulling the strings, maybe going against Steppenwolf in some way. I think maybe Steppenwolf might be sort of stepping out of line here in this film, perhaps. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of a wait-and-see approach. The DCEU has definitely turned out to be very interesting to watch. Say what you will about the movies themselves, but they are making interesting moves. And it's exciting to see play out. I hope it plays out well for them. I'm all for, you know, making these things as good as they can be. But, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see on that front. But sticking with the DCEU and moving on to something, speaking of obscure or more obscure, it sounds like Greg Berlanti is working on a Booster Gold movie. So let me clarify some things first of all. Greg Berlanti, he's the guy who created The Flash. And he's been doing all kinds of great stuff for the TV. The Flash, Arrow, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, all of that stuff is under the Greg Berlanti banner. And, you know, if you listen to a lot of fans, this is like true DC universe come to life. You know, it's great. I actually like a lot of the shows. I liked the first season of Arrow. For a while, I was into the second, but then I kind of got bored. Honestly, I kind of stopped. And then, you know, with Supergirl, I watched, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 episodes, and then I kind of just fell off of that one a bit. Same with Legends of Tomorrow. So I think right now The Flash is kind of the only one I'm keeping up with at this moment. So it's, you know, we'll see. I don't think he's a complete, you know, it's completely hitting on every front, but he's doing solid work on TV overall. Anyway, this has been kind of a big sort of lead up with various different sources. Zach Stentz, who wrote an episode of The Flash, who also wrote a draft of Thor, he was recently on an episode of Kevin Smith's Fat Man on Batman. And while on there, he was talking about he was working on a project with Greg Berlanti, and then basically that got stalled for a bit. And then Greg Berlanti was like, hey, you want to work on The Flash? And then, you know, Zach Stentz was like, hey, this is a good way for me to cut my teeth in TV again. And that was the first big hint thinking, oh, so he must have been working on a feature. And then it went on to, you know, I think it was, who was it? I think it was Birth, Movies, Death, went on to basically claim, oh, so this is actually a Booster Gold movie. He's a lesser-known DC character, kind of a showboaty type character, not unlike Iron Man in a way. You know, sort of full of himself, sort of funny. Last year, there was rumor that he was going to have a team-up movie with the Blue Beetle. But anyways, right now, Greg Berlanti is working on a Booster Gold movie with Zach Stentz, the writer. And it is not clear if he's going to direct it, but at the very least, it seems like he's going to end up as producer. We do not know how this is going to fit into the DCEU, if it's going to fit into the DCU, or if it's going to be its own thing. But if it does fit into the DCU, I know, I think Birth Movies Death was speculating, this maybe kind of goes into the whole theme that Warner Brothers is still trying to figure out what the DCEU is and sort of course correcting from the sort of the dreariness of Batman v Superman and thinking, let's inject some more comedy into this universe. And this seems like a potential way they could do that. Mario, what do you think about all of this I just said? I said a lot, I feel like, too much, but continue.
Well, hey, you're a passionate guy, and the DCEU is something worthy of our passion. So never apologize for that, Jamie. In terms of this, you know, I don't know. no, but like to me, this cuts. This isn't an anti-DC thing, you cocksuckers. Just in general, I
whatever.
I was just laughing at your resignation. You're just like, I don't fucking know. What are we talking about here?
No, it's just in terms of Booster Gold. Like for me, whenever I hear movies being developed for characters that are like, you know, C level, D level characters, I just start to wonder, like, you know, a part of me just wants to go, what are we doing here? You know, there's still a lot of great stories to be told about characters that we that already do have a great installed audience. So we start like scraping the bottom of the barrel with characters like Booster Gold or Cyborg. You know, I'm just like, why don't you focus on making an amazing Superman movie first?
But I think the plus side of staying away from those characters is they don't have people like you who, I mean this in the best way possible. people who are stuck on established versions of the character.
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
But like, I just wonder though, like, you know, these movies aren't cheap to make, and there's a lot of resources and a lot of pressure and a lot of, like, you know, a lot goes into this stuff. So when you're in a situation where you're still just trying to build something, the fact that you're already willing to talk about a Booster Gold movie, I'm like, I don't know where the priorities are. And similar, like, you know, going back to like Fox with like Gambit, like, you know, you got to really, if you're going to do this kind of stuff, you got to really make sure that you have someone in charge there that's going to make this character appeal to mass audiences. And, you know, with Booster Gold, I mean, I don't know.
Time travel abilities, that's about it, right?
My main Booster Gold is the fact that, like, you know, I know that he was in Death of Superman, and yeah, he factored in, like, I read that book, you know, the whole series of books, but the final novelization of it, like, a million times when I was a kid. So I know he's in there, and I know he's got some interesting stuff. I know that he was referenced in Man of Steel. There was a little, like, Easter egg to him.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, there's a thing. If you look, apparently there's, like, a comic book store sign in the background or a comic book company of some sort referenced in a billboard while Zod and Superman are destroying the world. That is a Booster Gold reference. So I know that he's been somewhat on their radar for a while, but I don't know. As of now, I could give two shits. So
do any of you watch Arrow or The Flash or any of those Greg Berlanti shows?
No, I watch Flash and The Arrow, like, you know, on a weekly basis, to be honest with you. I tried to watch Supergirl. I'll be honest with you, I only watched like probably three episodes, and then I watched a Flash episode and that was it. The other one, Legends of Tomorrow,
that's it.
Yeah.
That one, I only saw the first two episodes and I just gave up on it. I'm like, nah, I'm not interested.
Yeah, it gets better, but yeah, it's definitely has a rocky start.
Yeah, the Flash and the Arrow are the only two main ones that I'm like really hooked on, you know? Very good stories.
And how do you feel about the guy who created those shows hopping into a feature superhero flick?
I don't know. That's the thing, you know, it's like,
It's really hard when you look at those DCE movies that are so expensive, and you look at, like, The Flash, which is, you know, it looks fine for what it is, but it's definitely on a different level as far as what they're working on.
Definitely, with. You know, like, you know, we won't know until he tries it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the bottom line.
Tonally speaking, I get thrown off by this sort of stuff. You know what I mean? Because let's say it happens, right? Let's say, all right, they get the script, they get the funding, and it's going to be a Berlanti joint that's, you know, somewhat in line with all of his TV work, which there's no reason to think that he would suddenly change his approach.
In line tonally, you know, in the way he does the stories?
Yeah, like... And if it does end up feeling like a big budget Berlanti project, you know, taking the TV stuff and making it for the theater, you know, how is that going to stack up next to a lot of the other stuff that's coming out? You know, I know that Warner Brothers prides itself on trying to be, like, you know, filmmaker driven and let each director make its own, you know, make their own movie however it is they see fit. And then we see how to make that work later on. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that works when you're trying to create a shared universe, you know.
Not only that, it seems like what you were saying right now has been on their radar. It looks like it's been on their radar since, I think, what, 2013? I think Goyer had announced a while back that Booster Gold was in development. Back then, you know, they also had a Deathstroke movie and a Suicide Squad movie, which obviously is now is already done.
Yeah.
You know, but, and then at one time, I think like last year, Berlanti had said that he will direct a Booster Gold film. And I think at that time, Zach Penn was writing it. It's only come to light now that,
that's, you know, that was back when it was a Blue Beetle team up, right?
Right, yeah, exactly. A Blue Beetle movie in development. Yep. Yes, and that was announced, too. You know what I mean? That one was announced. But now, you know, with this Zach Stentz, you know, doing it, it's pretty different. And again, I never really followed Booster Gold at all. I never read any other comics. I don't know anything about it, to be honest with you. Nothing. Yeah. Just the fact that he has some sort of time travel abilities and stuff like that.
Yeah, for me, it all boils down to ultimately, just like with Dwayne Johnson's Shazam and some of the other stuff that we've heard about floating around with the DCEU, I'm going to file it just under I'll believe it when I see it. You know, exactly. They could talk about it now. They're developing it now. And if my research when writing this ongoing column I've been doing, the DCEU's Road to Ruin, if my research has shown me anything, you know, it's just that Warner Brothers, you know, they do this a lot. They get a lot of things into development. You know, there's a lot of little ideas that they'll put some money behind and then they'll scurry people off to go work on that never see the light of day. So this Booster Gold thing sounds interesting. Berlanti's playing a hot hand right now because of his TV work. But ultimately, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right. Well, recently, speaking of Greg Berlanti, he was asked if he would be willing to take on the Flash film. As you guys know, Seth Graham Smith, who was first on board to direct the Ezra Miller Flash movie, dropped out recently. And it's an open, you know, there's an open director's chair, and they asked if Greg Berlanti would be willing to take it on, and he said pretty much no. Grant Gustin, the guy who plays the Flash in the TV series, is his Flash, and he wouldn't continue with a Flash movie or direct a Flash movie without Grant Gustin in the role. You know, obviously, that's not him saying, I'm going to go make sure that happens. He's just saying probably no is what it comes down to. But yeah, I remember back when Ezra Miller was first cast as the Flash, and there was like a lot of fanboy outcry from those who love the TV show saying Grant Gustin should be the Flash. What do you guys think about that just as a concept? Do you guys think the Flash world works in the DCEU in any way, shape, or form? Let's start with you, Kelvin, since I know you actually watch the Flash.
That's the question that I keep asking myself sometimes. Would this Batman versus Superman film, would have it been good if he was in it instead of Ezra Miller, Grant, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of people that I know said that, you know, maybe it did, you know, lose a couple of millions of dollars because he wasn't in it. Can you imagine if he was? A lot of the people who see the show would have ran to the movie to see it, you know? I mean, he's a loyal guy, Berlanti. You know, he's not going to do a film without Grant, you know, and understandably so. But,
I see, mean... this stuff makes me think about some of the bochincha that we've mentioned for a couple of weeks now. No, but like, well, yeah, the stuff that we've heard about that behind the scenes, they're not too happy with Ezra Miller.
Yeah,
and exactly. I mean, if I'm honest, if I'm a suit at Warner Brothers right now, and I'm starting to think about a course correction, or I'm starting to, you know, think about how do we sort of, you know, redirect the direction we're heading in, I'm considering it. I'm considering Berlanti. I'm considering, like, you know, like, what can we do to maybe, you know, just adapt the Flash series into a movie and, you know, get the duo of Berlanti and Gustin together. You know, I'm not saying I pulled the trigger instantaneously, but it's a conversation. You know, I don't think it's out of the question, especially if what we've heard is true and that, you know, that they're not too happy with Ezra Miller and that, you know, and having just lost a director, you know, the production itself is in a sort of vulnerable state right now. So it's not out of the question that they would at least have this conversation, you know?
I don't know. Like, for me, it's just such a. It's such a tonal clash, not just style. Everything about it is just so different. I love The Flash, but it's very TV, just the way it's shot and the way it's done. It looks so different. It feels so different. And it's just I don't see it working out personally in a way that makes sense. His costume is very TV. I don't see it transitioning into the big screen. And even if they change his costume for the big screen version, you know, when they bring it back to TV, they don't necessarily have the same budget to bring that costume back into TV. So we're back to, you know, the way things were before. So I'm not sure how that would all work out. It may end up in an overly convoluted world, an overly convoluted timeline, you know, bringing it into a world, you know, where there's already essences of a multiverse, you know, as, you know, shown by Flash's cameo in Batman v Superman. So it just seems like a way to jump the shark really quick. So I don't see it happening.
Is it because you think the Flash looks sort of cheesy on TV?
Yeah, that's a part of it. But I mean, just not just cheesy the way it looks, but just the way the stories are told, the way the world is built, everything about it, it's just so drastically
cheesy.
Yeah.
It is cheesy, but it's a good cheesy.
No, yeah, it's definitely good. I love The Flash. Like, it's one of my favorite shows on TV right now, so don't get me
wrong.
And
I think what I see this thing reminds me a lot of what was happening back then with Tom Welling, that they all wanted him to be the next Superman instead of and then Ralph. And I remember the guys at I think it was CW back then? Or was it something else?
What year was this?
Well, originally it was the WB, and then it switched over to the CW. Yeah,
and they had this thing that they said that no suits,
no flights, no tights,
no flights, no tights, and all that stuff. And this is basically almost the same thing was going on with the Flash right now. You know, they don't want this kid to be in the film. You know, that's how I see it. I'm seeing it. Yeah, it reminded me of that of Smallville.
Yeah. I don't know. I also just think, too, sometimes people, you know, need a little bit of a reality check, too, when it comes to the successes on the CW network. You know, they're not on the same playing field as some of the other TV networks. And people sometimes don't realize that. Like, being number one on the CW is not the same as being number one on NBC or CBS, let's say. The expectations are far more dialed down. And it's, you know, CW doesn't even broadcast everywhere like CBS, NBC, Fox, and ABC do. So yeah, I'm just bringing this up because sometimes I think we overestimate the popularity of these shows.
Right.
Because they're doing great on the CW, and they're, you know, and they can tout, you know, it's the number one show on this network. But this network doesn't get seen much.
Well, this
it's easy to be number one.
This transitions perfectly into our next story. Supergirl's heading to the CW. Now, I think it's worth noting that right now The Flash is the highest rated show on the CW from what I heard. And from last I checked, each episode was getting, like, I don't know, anywhere from 3.5 to 4 million viewers each episode.
Exactly.
And Supergirl.
And NBC, you're canceled with that.
And CBS, Supergirl, which is where... Excuse me, try that again. CBS is where Supergirl was being aired for the first season. The ratings, I think, started around 12, and it ended up hovering around 8 to 7.5 million. And it got canceled on CBS and got moved to the CW. Like, it did better than The Flash. It did better than all those shows on there. And, you know, it still got canceled and moved over to the CW. So, yeah, I think we do.
Well, because it was still behind the Monday night sitcoms, the comedy one.
But the point is that, you know, it's a different ball game when it comes to certain networks. And I think...
Oh, yeah, yeah, because you're dealing with the big boys with CBS, ABC, and NBC compared to what Mario was saying, CW.
Exactly.
Yeah, and DC TV fans need to, like, realize that and really sort of, you know, digest that. That, yeah, you know, these things are very popular, and then they're doing amazing business on the CW, and, you know, like, they're, like, the flagship shows. But if you stack them up, the viewership for those shows are not even enough to be renewed for a second season on other networks.
You could do twice. Yeah, like, Supergirl did twice as well as The Flash and wasn't good enough to get picked up as on CBS.
Which is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and what about Gotham? How's that doing on Fox? They renewed it again, didn't they, or no?
I do not know. I fell off of that show early in season two.
Well, while you look into that, Jammer, I'll just talk about the shift of Supergirl to CW. Sure. I mean, it seems like a natural, logical fit. It's, you know, all the Berlanti DC shows are on the CW. They recently just had the whole Flash Supergirl crossover. So to me, it makes perfect sense. But, you know, you have to remember also that the CW, you know, it's at a lower budget. So I haven't seen Supergirl, but just whatever production value it is for you fans out there who watch Supergirl, you know, the production value is going to take a hit. So just remember that, you know, we're going to rejoice that it's coming back for season two. And I actually want to check out Supergirl. Some of the stuff that I've heard on it, some of the things I've seen in little previews and clips, you know, I'm actually very much intrigued by Supergirl.
It's very bubblegummy.
Okay. All right. Well, either way, I want to check it out. We just have to remember that, like, you know, while we're all excited that she's going to get season two, it's going to come at a cost, and it's going to be a literal cost where the production budget is going to take a hit. So just be ready for that. Embrace yourselves for, you know, a slightly cheaper looking show when it comes back for season two.
Right. And what about cast?
I mean, I assume everyone's coming over. You know, that would be, you know, since it is a continuation of the same series, it's not a reboot or anything. You know, I assume they're going to have the same cast.
Yeah, that was my assumption too. Did you hear anything else different, Kelvin?
No. I was reading about it too. That they were saying, who knows if the cast will come back because, you know, everybody has to move to Vancouver now. You know, right. And this first season was all filmed in L.A.
I'm sure really? They will. Yeah.
Huh. Who knows, they might
have to take a pay cut. So that's kind of a, you know, now I have to move to Vancouver. You have to live there for a few months. Yeah. And I don't think some of the cast members want to go to Vancouver.
I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, me either. But we'll see what happens with that. But either way, I want to finish the rest of season one of Supergirl, which I enjoyed for what it was. It was fun. It was a bit cheesy and bubblegummy. It was cheesier than The Flash. It was kind of like, honestly, for the first few episodes, I felt like it was, you know, the female version of The Flash in tone and style. But upon watching more and more of each show, I feel like, no, they're more distinct and different than I originally thought they were. But either way, I'm interested to see more from Supergirl, especially if it ventures to the CW. I imagine the episodes will be smaller in scope and more character-focused and less maybe tropesy-focused. Maybe, yeah. Probably like one a season or something.
And this almost kind of ties into what you said earlier, Jammer, about how, you know, constraint breeds creativity.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, maybe the tighter budget will make them write a better show.
Maybe. I agree. I hope that's the case because I have nothing but positive intentions for Supergirl. Moving on out of the Berlanti verse. Oh, you forgot to give it that awesome headline. Mario.
I know. We just exited our Berlanti block.
And moved into Star Wars. So I know one of the big questions coming out of Star Wars The Force Awakens, which was answered by, you know, various outlets in various ways, but it had to do with what are the politics of the Star Wars universe that we saw? Like, what is the First Order? What is the Resistance? Like, how are these two connected with each other? It wasn't entirely clear. However, in a recent report from IO9, via Star Wars News, they talked with they talked about Rian Johnson, the director of Episode 8, which is upcoming, and he had input in one of the latest Star Wars books called Bloodline, which is written by Claudia Gray, and his contribution was as follows. The New Republic, this has to do with the world of Star Wars, The New Republic has become divided into two factions: populists, who desire to see a new government united between other joining planets. The other factions are known as centrists, who demand a military-controlled government. The centrist faction begin to secede from the New Republic to form the First Order with the aid of remnants from the Empire. And from there, what I recall from other... This is me, by the way, not the quote. And from what I recall, Princess Leia and all of her stuff, all of her people and the Resistance are being funded by the Republic in secret to sort of take care of this rise of the First Order, which I guess is still not officially out. People don't really officially know it's a thing. So that's kind of how the politics of this new world are. So I thought that was just interesting and maybe worth noting for those who weren't quite sure about how the politics are.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I wish some of this would have somehow found its way into The Force Awakens, because, you know, I think it would have helped battle some of the retread nature of it, where a lot of people felt like it's, you know, this is all stuff we've seen before. Because for me, like, you know, the Resistance was just a stand-in for the Rebellion, and the First Order was just a stand-in for the Empire without any real, you know, differentiation. And maybe finding out some of the backstory, I feel, would have helped. And I also, there was something included in that piece also that apparently, like, you know, in the novelization, we're going to see something where, you know, Leia reveals that she is Darth Vader's daughter. And that's one of the reasons that she has to leave, you know, the Rebellion or whatever it is, you know, it's one of the reasons that she has to go off and splinter off and form the Resistance, because now she's basically been shunned kind of off to the side because she's Vader's daughter.
And that's
I just feel like, yeah, and to me, like, I feel like that would have been sort of cool to have integrated into The Force Awakens somehow, so it wouldn't just feel like it's just the Empire versus the Rebellion again.
And you'll probably see that on Episode 8. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe. You know, it's something, because I was at the Barnes & Nobles in Long Island this weekend, and I saw the book, and I opened it, started reading a couple of things, and then the next thing you know, I saw the posters that were inside. And it's funny about the politics. You open it and it says liar, and had her face crossed off, and Darth Vader on top of it.
So yeah.
Thing about Darth Vader being, you know, her father, you can tell that she was, you know, thrown to the dungeon because of that, you know?
Yeah. Like that, I think that would have been a very interesting element to somehow incorporate into The Force Awakens.
Yeah, but at the same time, I really like the fact that Force Awakens was really focused and kind of nixed all the politics out, because that stuff, admittedly, is kind of boring. We're more on board with the characters and what their personal plights are than we are about the world itself, as much as we love the world. Okay, so moving on from there, we have one more Star Wars story. It's something of a rumor. We all know that Daniel Craig had a cameo in Star Wars The Force Awakens, and it was one of the more memorable scenes, like exchanges that Rey had between her and a stormtrooper, the whole mind control. It's where she first kind of uses the Force, and it's pretty great. According to Making Star Wars, they believe that Tom Hardy has a cameo very similar to that in the film, and this is what they say. Tom Hardy plays a First Order stormtrooper. Said stormtrooper glimpses at Finn on a secret mission, but doesn't realize it. The incognito Finn is surprised when the stormtrooper walks up behind him and slaps him on the ass. Finn turns around and believes he's dead. He's surely going to be captured. But the stormtrooper is elated to see his old friend back during their First Order Academy days. The stormtrooper congratulates Finn on his promotion to Resistance Infiltrator and Spy. And Finn is free to go about his business to his amazement. So that is supposedly an exchange between Tom Hardy's character and Finn's character in Episode 8. What do you think of this scene, Kelvin?
To be honest with you, I don't care.
Okay.
I really don't. I mean, because you don't see him, right? You don't see the Tom Hardy, right? You don't see him at all.
Just a stormtrooper.
He's on the stormtrooper, just like Daniel Craig. You did it. Who knows if that was Daniel Craig underneath that?
Right.
You know what I mean? You don't know. So it doesn't, you know, it's cool, but I'm not to like, oh my God, you know what I mean?
Mario? Yeah, to me it sounds like the same sort of just cute little Daniel Craig moment. I have a feeling, though, since Hardy is known for playing such like a badass, I wouldn't be surprised if there is just a little bit of a bookend on that, where later on in that sequence, when shit does go down, you know, him and Hardy have a little throwdown, Finn versus Hardy, when Hardy realizes that Finn isn't on their side anymore, and he's not a double agent. He actually is just against the First Order now, you know? So I wouldn't be surprised if this one, unlike the Craig one, does have a follow-up. But ultimately, you know, it'll be cute, it'll be funny, and not too much to say about this.
So according to the Wrap, WB is going to be pushing back the release of Godzilla 2 and announcing King Kong versus Godzilla. So Godzilla 2 was originally scheduled to release on June 8th, 2018, but is now opening on March 22nd, 2019.
Yes. By the way, you're going to hear Sebastian in the background once in a while. My little two-year-old has a lot to say about this issue.
Okay. And the epic crossover between King Kong versus Godzilla will open on March 29th, 2020. This isn't necessarily huge news. They shift dates and stuff all around. As we know, the stuff over at WB is kind of in flux at the moment as they sort of regain their bearings following the disappointing box office returns from Batman v Superman. But the big news in regards to Godzilla 2 has to do with director Gareth Edwards, who directed the first Godzilla and is finishing up his work on Rogue One, a Star Wars story. And now it sounds like he's exited Godzilla 2. Which is disappointing. What do you have to say about this, Mario?
I mean, honestly, I don't find it that disappointing. I thought Godzilla was disappointing. I know I'm in the minority. You know, when that movie came out, it did a lot of great business, and a lot of people were saying, like, this is so cool. It's like a true Godzilla movie, unlike the Roland Emmerich one from the 90s. For me, honestly, you know, when I saw it, I thought, all right, it's okay. You know, it didn't really blow me away. So Gareth Edwards moving away from Godzilla doesn't really make me all that worried or all that sad. I just hope they get someone who, you know, aside from the things that were wrong with the movie, you could tell Gareth Edwards loved the character and he seemed to be very into the subject material. So I hope they find someone also who brings that sort of like drive to make a good Godzilla movie. But, you know, the loss of Edwards himself doesn't really, you know, doesn't really worry me all that much.
And apparently the departure was amicable between him and Warner Brothers and Legendary and all that. So that sounds promising, but I mean, of course, they're not going to say we had a freaking drop down fight and everything. They're not going to say that.
Yeah.
But I do wonder the reason behind his move. Like, he did two big movies back to back, Godzilla and Rogue One. I'm wondering if he wants to either take a break or if he wants to do something smaller, or if maybe Disney has something else in store for him in regards to Star Wars in general. So. I'm curious if what the follow-up of this is going to be. What is Edwards going to work on next? Is he going to disappear for a while or what? So that is most what I'm looking forward to. But yeah, as far as – go ahead.
No, and I feel like a lot of that hinges on how well Rogue One does, you know, because – if that does really well, then he'll be a made man in Hollywood, and he'll be able to just do whatever he wants, you know, because we know how the Star Wars brand is huge. The Force Awakens was, you know, a force unto itself. And if Rogue One comes out in December and does anything similar to what Episode 7 did, you know, Gareth Edwards is going to be untouchable. So I am curious to see how that movie does. And how you know, how it affects his career, because it really could be a career maker for him. If it comes out and underperforms, then you know that'll be something else to monitor as well. But there's a lot riding on Rogue One.
So continuing on with our kaiju theme, it sounds like Pacific Rim 2 has a new screenwriter in Jurassic World screenwriter Derek Connolly. Pacific Rim 2 is a film that's kind of been on and off again. It's, you know, was set, had a date, I think, at one point, and then it's just like it got pulled out and all kinds of drama going on behind the scenes. It's surprising, honestly, that they're even doing it. I know it did really well overseas, but overall, I'm not sure it did that great in order to want a sequel.
No, it didn't really.
Yeah, and the fact that they're continuing forward with it is surprising to me, and it keeps kind of going on and off again. But Derek Connolly, I think he did a pretty good job where he was one of the co-writers of Jurassic World, I think, along with the director whose name escapes me, Colin Trevorrow.
Yeah.
And I think he could bring something to it. I know a lot of people really rag on Jurassic World and say, oh, it really was a shitty movie that somehow did really well. But I think there was something in it that worked. I liked the characters in it. I liked its tone. I liked the style that they went for. And sort of its sort of loving nod to the original. I think it did a lot more right than people give it credit for. And I hope he brings that aspect to Pacific Rim 2, because Pacific Rim 1 was a movie that I was very disappointed in. Like, I was so excited to go see, you know, giant monsters fight, but I couldn't get over how bored I was during most of the movie, how little I cared for the characters, and how much I hated on-screen action, because it was mostly them knee-deep in water fighting in the dark rain, and it wasn't fun for me to watch. There was one fight scene that was heavily shown in the trailers, which is that one where it uses the ship to fight the other kaiju, which was awesome. Yeah. But apart from that, I just didn't like a whole lot of it. It kind of took in my opinion, the surface elements of anime that, you know, most mainstream audiences see and kind of threw it on the big screen, but didn't really go much deeper than that. And it just felt shallow to me. So hopefully Derek Connolly will bring something else to it that was missing in the first one for me personally. I know I'm in the minority there, but
I mean, I'm like on the, I felt, you know, with Jurassic World, it didn't do much for me. I'm part of the, you said you're part of the minority. I'm part of the majority, unfortunately, here. Mm-hmm. I thought Jurassic World, like the screenplay didn't really do much for me. To me, a lot of the story just felt very much like a means to an end. We just need to connect certain dots. We need to do some nostalgic bits, and we need to have all of these little bullet points of a movie occur so we can have all the dinosaur stuff happen. The script for me and none of the dialogue really stood out. The characters didn't really pop for me. To me, it felt very generic.
Don't get me wrong. It felt very archetypal for sure, but in a way that worked for me.
Yeah, no, I got you.
Yeah.
It played it very safe, and that's what it needed to do. It wanted to relaunch the Jurassic World property. So, and it did that, like, and then some. So good. They did it right. But for me, his screenplay for that didn't really do much of anything for me. So hearing that he's doing Pacific Rim 2, a sequel that in and of itself, I was sort of mystified is happening. And this whole development is a big fat thumbs in the middle for me.
Okay. Cool. Well, that about wraps it up for us. Then that's our last story for the day.
All right.
So, go ahead and take us away.
All right. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us for this 14th edition of Lost Fanboys. I hope you enjoyed it. I know we enjoyed recording it. As always, please be sure to subscribe and rate and share and follow us on Facebook at Latino Review. Follow us on Twitter at LR News. Tweet things to hashtag Lost Fanboys. Let us know what you think. Comment on the post when we put this up later. And, we look forward to chatting again with you next week. So from all of us here at Latino Review Media, adios.
Adios.
Peace.